Imagine being mauled by a grizzly bear so ferociously that your companions presume you are dead. Then waking up, crawling, hobbling, and dragging yourself 250 miles of wild terrain, armed with nothing but sheer will and revenge in your veins. That's not The Revenant. That's the real story of Hugh Glass. History is messy,
weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're Rainy Day Rabbit Holes,
exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole. So today we're diving into one of the most absolutely crazy, intense survival stories of American history. And I know what you're thinking. Oh, you mean that Leonardo DiCaprio movie where he gets mauled by a CGI bear and grunts for 2.5 hours?
With the bear or Leonardo DiCaprio?
Because he has to grunt his way back. Okay. But that's a yes and no. The Revenant is based on Hugh Glass's story. But let me tell you, Hollywood simultaneously took some serious creative liberties, but also didn't even cover half the story. This man survived a lot.
Also, I would have liked that movie a lot better if Leonardo DiCaprio wasn't in it. I'm just not a fan of his.
I'm just not either. I just watched a movie, one of his latest ones. I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, he looks like Jack Nicholson to me. Like,
what? He's not aging well, is
he? And then we were watching movie previews, and you know, Keith loves all the old movies, and there was an older one with Jack Nicholson in it, and I'm like, look, he looks like Leonardo DiCaprio. And Keith's yes, he does. It's crazy.
Just not a fan of him as an actor or a person. Apparently he's got some very gross misogynistic something.
He likes them young.
Yeah.
At least he seems to like them at least over 18. That I've heard.
But not over 25.
But probably only because of the law.
Right. Allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly. All right. So the real story, it's somehow even more brutal and unbelievable than what you saw on screen. So buckle up, because we're about to talk about a man who survived a grizzly bear attack that should have killed him instantly, crawled 200 miles through the wilderness with injuries that would make a horror movie director squeamish, and then walked around another 1,500 miles to confront the men who left him for dead.
Oh, geez.
Here's the thing about Hugh Glass. We don't know a whole lot about his early life. This is the early 1800s, so record keeping was not exactly the priority, especially out on the frontier.
Exactly.
But what we do know, or at least what the historians have pieced together, is this. Hugh Glass was born in 1783 in Pennsylvania. His family was Scots-Irish, which, if you know anything about Scots-Irish people, this explains a lot about his stubbornness and refusal to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's in his blood.
The Scottish are fairly tough MOBs.
These were tough, hardscrabble people who didn't take crap from anyone. Around 1795, when Glass was about 20 years old, he left home. Why? We don't know. Maybe wanderlust, maybe got in trouble, maybe just looking around Pennsylvania and thought, there's just not enough ways to die here, so I'm going to have to venture out. Whatever the reason he left, and that decision set him on a path that would eventually lead him to becoming one of the most legendary figures in American frontier history. So what did the young Hugh Glass do right after leaving Pennsylvania? He became a sailor.
Oh, I was going to say he went and had sex with a sex worker. Sorry, probably.
Gosh, you know,
especially if he was going to become a sailor.
In all of my research, I didn't see any of that behavior. There's only one section we'll talk about where even a love interest even appears, and it's very brief in the story.
Oh, was he of a Lewis and Clark persuasion then?
Maybe. I think he was just too busy out being a savage. It's like no interest in this.
Maybe his love interest went towards the hairy ladies of the wilderness like the bears.
Could be.
Maybe that's why he got mauled by a bear because he was trying to have sex with it.
She said, enough hitting on me. I told you no.
No means no.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how it happened.
Sorry.
So he became a sailor, not just any sailor. According to some accounts, he eventually became the ship captain. This is where Glass's story starts to sound like someone just mashing it together. The timelines don't really make sense. Everything he does from here on out, he does for about 2 to 3 2 to 3 years about 5 different things, but all of those 2 to 3 years seem to be the same 2 to 3 years. Okay. So it's really hard.
Yeah. And how did he become the captain of a ship? Like, that's right. Not just like out I show nowhere. Up and you're like, I'm the captain now.
Right. And he was only there for 2 or 3 years. So I'm not sure how
but
this
happens.
But
it's the 1700s. So records, it's a lot of like people saying like, I did this thing. And then somebody saying he did this thing. And then somebody saying he told me that he said that he did that thing. And that's,
well, and a
it's
lot
like
of
a
this
game
is
of telephone.
People documenting what Hugh Glass himself told them about his own life. So,
so it could be all made up and could, we just try to piece it together with records that
with
we
records
find. Because there might be
fits.
Like a, mm-hmm. he was, you know, a register of a ship on
right,
this
exactly.
date. And you're like, okay, we know he was on that ship
yes.
at that date. But the
some
the
of the stories that
in
go
between,
with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is fine. It still makes a great story.
So somewhere between 1816 and 1820, Glass was sailing in the Gulf of Mexico. I actually made that red and bold.
It's the Gulf of Mexico.
I refuse to say anything
it's Mount
else.
Mount Denali.
When his ship had the absolute worst luck possible, they encountered Jean Lafitte's pirates.
Ooh, nice job.
All right.
These actually sound kind of sexy. I'm on the side
like,
of the pirates.
I practiced that so many times, I don't think it ever came out like that. Good job.
They sound a lot sexier than I'm sure they were because they're sailors. They're pirates. They probably smelled bad.
They had to. Otherwise, I picture everyone did.
There's probably a full complement of teeth between the whole crew.
So now if you don't know who Jean
Lafitte
was, let me paint a picture for you. This guy was basically the most successful pirate in the Gulf of Mexico, and he was a legitimate criminal who ran massive smuggling and piracy operations at what is known now as Galveston Island, Texas.
Can you do an episode about him, please?
Right? I know. That's why I was thinking this.
Sounds exciting.
Another rabbit hole.
We haven't done a pirate episode yet.
I think you should do that one and wear your pirate outfit.
I do have well, that's not going to help for audio listeners.
Just no, I'll do it, but you have to wear your pirate outfit so I can look at it and it'll inspire me through my whole story.
No, because my giant hat and feather are just going to keep hitting things. It'll be so obnoxious. Okay, anyway, go on. I'm sorry. I'm got very excited about French-sounding pirates.
So Glass's ship gets captured by Lafitte's crew, and here's where Glass faces his first major choice. Be a pirate or die.
Pirate, please.
Yep, so he became a pirate temporarily. He must have felt like that would be a better choice than dying. Mm-hmm. Glass ends up living in Campeche, which is Lafitte's pirate settlement on the Galveston Island. So they aren't always on the ship. I don't know why. I just thought they were always on the ship, but they actually have a place where they hang out. Not when they're not at sea.
So the ship is just like their office.
Yeah, exactly.
It's my work location, exactly. My work housing.
This place, this camp, was rough, filled with violent criminals, smugglers, and people who would slit your throat for a decent pair of boots. I feel like that was the era, too. The settlement was surrounded by dangerous waters, and the Karankawa natives, who were not fans of pirates, setting up shop on their land.
I'm with them on that.
Right? The Karankawa had a reputation for being fierce warriors, and they made life difficult for the pirates whenever possible.
Fair.
Glass lived this life for about a year or two.
Or two, like he did with every phase of his life. I went to college for a year or two. I was a pirate for a year or two.
But by all accounts, he absolutely hated it. He did not want to be a pirate and was doing this against his will. He was a prisoner with slightly more freedom than the guy in chains and was looking for any opportunity to get the hell out of there. And eventually that opportunity came. Here's where Glass shows the first real glimpse of the absolute madman that he would become. Glass and a companion whose name is never reported. So I'm not sure.
Bob.
Bob. We'll go Bob. So Glass and his companion who was never named Bob. We're going to name him Bob. Glass and his companion, whose name has been lost to history, unfortunately, decided that he'd had enough of pirate life. But you can't just walk off from Jean Lafitte's crew. You need a plan. Mm-hmm. During some kind of pirate tribunal meeting where they were all on shore and Glass and his companion were still on the ship, they decided now's the time. They jumped ship and they swam. Not just a little swim.
Shark-infested waters.
Yep. They swam for 2 whole miles in shark-infested waters on the Gulf of Mexico and wow. were also being shot at by other pirates.
Oh, God.
But they made it to shore and were safe for now.
According to Glass.
So Glass and his companion are now on the Texas shore, soaking wet and exhausted. They start making their way inland, trying to put as much distance between themselves and Lafitte's pirates as possible.
And then they come across a Trump store. Sorry, it's Texas.
Yes. And then they run into the Pawnee tribe.
Ooh.
The Pawnee were a powerful Native American tribe, and they weren't exactly thrilled about random white guys wandering through their territory again. Glass and his companion were quickly captured, and this is where things get really dark for Glass's buddy, because the Pawnee decided that this was the perfect time for a ceremonial sacrifice, and they burned him alive.
Oh, Bob.
They did not just burn him alive, though. First, they took pine needles and stuck them into his skin all over his body till he looked like a porcupine.
Ooh.
And then they lit him on fire. Glass watched.
Oh, that'd be very uncomfortable.
I mean, the whole time. First of all, it'd be so tedious, take forever to do this. And each, you know, they keep poking you with needles. That hurts. And then they're going to set you on fire. And it was a ceremonial sacrifice. So
you,
I wonder,
probably
what they
smelled kind of good. A pine.
Like a burning Christmas tree.
A barbecue.
Yeah. So you escape from the pirates, swim 2 miles through shark-infested water, and watch your friend die in the most horrible way. And now you don't know what's coming next for you. But for Hugh Glass, again, gets luck. The Pawnee did not need another sacrifice at the moment, so they were keeping Hugh for future needs. But during his travels with the tribe, Glass at some point offers them vermilion. So it makes red dye for their items.
He just happened to have it on him?
I guess. Yes. I mean, he's a pirate. Yeah, that's what I was thinking the whole time. I mean, I looked at various sources because I'm like, okay, he swam with vermilion in his pocket and it's fine. He must have had it in a Ziploc baggie.
But this is his tale. So
yeah. So
we're rolling with it.
Vermilion is very valuable to the Pawnee. And so they, instead of making him a sacrifice, they incorporate him into their tribe and he begins to live with them and they teach him their ways, which he comes to use in the future because it's all survival and how to live within the land and nature.
What is vermilion?
It's called something clay, red clay or something, but it's,
oh, it's a mineral?
It's a mineral, but they use it to dye like their clothing and stuff.
Okay.
Red. And so that's,
yeah, I just want to know what it was made out of, if it was like an animal-based thing or a mineral-based thing.
They would use it on their for war paint and stuff too. So it was valuable to them. So apparently that made him one of the tribe. He even took a wife at some point and lived with them for how long?
One to two years.
Yes. Exactly.
This guy, he's creating a very intricate, deep and detailed story.
Exactly. And I think his stories are interesting enough that people who collected his stories didn't just preserve them, but made sure to, they're good stories, right? Can't all be real shame.
No.
I'm trying.
No, I know. And that's the thing is like,
because we're not even halfway. I haven't even gotten to the good stuff.
I mean, he's a character who has his own backstory that he's told of himself.
Now, there is documentation on a lot of these things as far as we get further into the story, trappers have documentation,
right,
and he's been on a ship.
But some of this backstory is a little bit
maybe
fantastic.
I'm wondering if like there's like a sliver of truth and then it gets
big fished.
Yeah.
Okay, so he lived with them for 1 to 2 years, took a wife, and then what?
He learned all of his survival skills, how to make modern tools out of things from nature. And then Glass decides at some point to leave the Pawnee. It doesn't say why, that we don't know how, and I have no idea what happened to this wife. She doesn't have a name. There doesn't.
1 to 2 years there, and he's got to move on.
Got to move on. I don't know if they had children. I don't know anything about the relationship, so it's very interesting. But eventually, when he leaves the Pawnee in March of 2023, he joins up with...
Whoa, 2023?
I'm sorry, 1823. Wow, that's like 200 years ago. Crazy.
200 years off. Normally, we say 1923 instead by accident.
I was just watching last night with Keith Star Trek. I know you can't believe it. I've never watched before. But anyway, it was the one where they brought in... Gosh, I can't remember his name, but the guy that's from the 1990s where they were doing eugenics, and then they made a whole another series about this character. Where was I even going with this story?
Well, I said 2020.
Oh, you said anyway. So they're talking about 1990, and then they tell this guy, "You've been asleep for 200 years," and it's just, can you imagine? Now I'm talking about some 200. I digress. Let's go back. Okay, so March of 1823, Hugh Glass has joined up with William Ashley's fur trading expedition, heading up the Missouri River. Here's something important. Glass was about 48 years old by this point, because you know, when he leaves in his 20s and spends 1 to 2 years doing things in the same 1 to 2 years. Anyway.
Oh, he's in his 40s now?
Yeah,
he's
48.
20 some odd years doing adventures around the high seas.
And yeah, escaping pirates and Native American tribes.
But 1 to 2 years at a time. So yeah. Interesting. Okay.
And 48 years old in the 1820s is really old. Life expectancy was much lower, and the kind of hard living that Glass had done would have aged him even more. In fact, all the other trappers called him Old Glass.
Oh my God.
48 years old, you're the old man.
1 year older than me.
It's a long time ago for me. But Glass wasn't some decrepit old man. He was tough as nails, experienced, and he knew how to survive in conditions that would kill younger, less experienced men. And Ashley's expedition was heading into dangerous territory. They needed men who could handle themselves, and Glass fit the bill perfectly. William Ashley was a businessman and a politician who saw the potential of massive profits in the fur trade. He organized expeditions up the Missouri River to trap beaver and other animals whose pelts were worth a fortune back east. Apparently, they at some point decided beaver pelts were the hat to have. And so it became a big deal for these trappers to go get them.
Yeah, Hudson Bay Company knew that. Upcoming episode.
These expeditions were dangerous, and you were dealing with hostile Native American tribes, dangerous wildlife, could be wildfires.
Sure.
Extreme weather and disease, and constantly the possibility of starvation or injury, far from any kind of medical help. So really,
whatever medical help was available in
1823 or whatever. That's what I was thinking when I was this story. I'm like, it wouldn't even matter, I don't think, at that
They're
going
to put a leech on you and rub some mercury in it.
We do get maggots in this story.
Which actually are beneficial.
Okay. The expedition hadn't made it far when things went sideways. On June 2nd, 1823, I said that right, 1823?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You're now worried that you're saying 2023 yes. constantly.
Ashley's group encountered the Arikara tribe near their villages in present-day South Dakota. The Arikara tribe were not happy, once again, with white trappers coming through their territory.
Don't blame them.
There had been tensions building for a while, and on that day, those tensions exploded into violence. The Arikara attacked Ashley's expedition in what became one of the worst disasters in the early fur trade. 14 men were killed, 10 more were wounded, including Hugh Glass, who took arrow to the leg, his first real injury. After the battle, Ashley's expedition was in chaos. They lost men, supplies, and morale. So they had to regroup and figure out what to do next. The decision was made to split up into smaller groups. It was thought that smaller parties would be less likely to attract attention and could move more quickly through dangerous territory. Mm-hmm. Glass ended up in a group led by Andrew Henry, heading toward Fort Henry. No relation to Andrew Henry.
Henry was just a very popular name.
On the Yellowstone River. This group would be traveling through some of the most remote and dangerous wilderness in North America. In August or September of 1823, the exact date is lost to history, but the location is near the Grand River in present-day South Dakota. Andrew Henry's party is making its way through the wilderness, and Hugh Glass is doing what experienced trappers do. He's ranging ahead of the main group. He is hunting for game to feed everyone else. Glass is moving through thick brush near a stream, and visibility is poor. He focused on looking for deer or elk or anything that would make a good meal for many men. And then suddenly, he's face to face with a grizzly bear. Not just any grizzly bear, a mother grizzly bear with two cubs.
Yikes, the worst kind.
Mama Bear was ready to do what mama bears are known for. The bear didn't give him time to react. She charged. What happened next is brutal. This was not a quick attack. It went on and on. This was a sustained, vicious mauling. His companions heard him screaming and came running. The bear grabbed Glass and threw him around like a rag doll. She broke his leg. She ripped his scalp partially off his skull. She tore open his throat so badly his windpipe trachea was visible and punctured. He was actually breathing out the side of his neck.
Oh, God.
She shredded his back with her claws, exposing his ribs. She tore flesh from his lower body and limbs. His hands and arms, which he was using to fight, were somehow still functional, but the rest of him was destroyed.
Oh my God.
Glass, in the middle of this attack, managed to grab his knife. When the bear was literally tearing apart, he was stabbing her, trying to kill her, or at least make her stop. Eventually, between Glass's knife work and the arrival of his companions who shot the bear, the attack ended. The bear was dead. And now we have cubs with no mama.
I know.
And Hugh Glass should have been too.
But now they also have bear meat to eat.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking that and they don't ever talk about that. It's like they just pack up and run. And I'm like, why would you leave that?
I bet you they took some bear meat. Because if they're constantly looking for food, they would just leave. A bear is hundreds of pounds of meat.
Hundreds of pounds. And the warmth from that.
The bear. The fur. Yeah. These are fur trappers. Mm-hmm. No, they would have. But it would have been this is what we would have done anyways. We don't need to mention it.
Oh, it could be. Yeah. So when his companions reached him, they found a scene that must have looked like a slaughterhouse, but somehow, impossibly, he was still alive. Andrew Henry and the rest of the party looked at Hugh Glass and saw a dead man. There was no way he was going to survive. His injuries were too severe. They were in the middle of nowhere, and there were no medical supplies beyond basic first aid, and Glass was torn to pieces. But they couldn't just leave him there. He was still alive. He was still breathing, and even though it was from a hole in his neck. They made a litter or a stretcher and carried him. For 2 days, they carried this dying man through the wilderness, probably expecting him to die at any moment.
He should have died.
So that they could bury him and go on their way.
But the most they would have done is bandaged him. And then what else? Like infection would be setting in, and you've had all this blood loss and...
It is insane.
I don't understand.
This part of the story is well documented and true. The bear attack and the story.
Because you had a bunch of other people.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk about the movie's portrayal of it. Apparently, they didn't even do a thorough job. As violent and gory as it was and how awful it was in the movie is not even accurate to how bad it really was, his injuries. So that's insane to me.
Wow. Tough as nails, man.
Because... You know, like we all know, he survives. So for 2 days, he's still alive. After 5 days, he's still alive. And this presented Andrew Henry with a serious problem. They were in hostile territory. Mm-hmm. They were moving slowly because of Glass. Every day they stayed in one place or moved too slowly was another day they could be attacked by the Arakara, who were hunting them.
Plus, you have to find food for your whole party. And yeah, man, that's rough. There's probably people that are like, I should leave them.
Yes, and so here we are. Henry had to think about the safety of his entire party, and Glass was slowing them down. So Henry made a decision. He asked for volunteers to stay with Glass until he was dead, then bury him, and then catch up with the main group.
It's like, this guy is going to die. Why are we dragging him along with us?
Right. And I'm surprised they didn't actually just put him out of his misery, because he had to have been...
In so much pain.
So much pain. Suffering. If he was conscious, he was in pain. You know what I mean? And there was no hope for him to live. I'm surprised.
His wounds were probably starting to fester.
Yep.
He was probably starting to smell worse than he already did.
Right?
He wasn't starting to smell bad. He was just starting to smell worse.
Worse. Yeah.
Fur trappers exactly. In the 1800s, they all smelled terrible.
So he offered payment for this grim duty, and two men volunteered, John Fitzgerald and a young man who is possibly Jim Bridger. This is the part of the story where the documentation is, there's not firm documentation. Jim Bridger is another story that we could do, becomes a very well-known trapper and runs his own expeditions and things. And so he's a well-known name, and it could be him, but it could be a different Bridger. And then there's documentation where they use Bridgers, and so they're like, that's a different guy. So anyway, that piece is not clear who this young man is, but it is clear that it's a 19-year-old-ish guy.
Well, and at that time, there was a lot more people that had the same exact name.
Yeah. The main party moved on, and Fitzgerald and the young man stayed with Glass, waiting for him to die so they could bury him and collect payment. They waited and waited. And Glass kept not dying.
Oh, God. Why won't this guy die?
After 5 days of this, Fitzgerald had had enough. They were sitting ducks out there. Every day they stayed was another day they could be killed by hostile natives. And Glass was clearly going to die anyway. Every day they stayed was another day they could be killed by hostile natives. And Glass was clearly going to die anyway. So Fitzgerald made a decision that would hurt. So Fitzgerald made a decision that would haunt Hugh Glass for the rest of his life and give him a reason to survive when he should have died 100 times over. Mm-hmm. And now that you are trapped here in our riveting story of survival, and we're going to take a quick break to ensure our own survival. Welcome back, and hopefully you did not encounter a pirate attack or pine needle sacrifice or a bear attack. Fitzgerald and his companion took Glass's rifle. They took his knife. They took his tomahawk. They took his fire-making kit. They took everything he would have needed to help him survive.
Because they're like, you're going to die. And we need this. And we're not going to leave you with anything that's useful that could help us survive. Which I mean, I kind of like can't blame these
guys. He spends most of this time unconscious, can't talk. His eyes are moving at times. They report that that's basically the, you know, the most communication he's got. So, you know, there's no way this guy's going to, he's not going to be able to use any of these tools.
I don't think you can fault these guys for
You can't use these tools. So he can't even get up and function to use them. So we're going to take these.
Because they're going to help us survive.
I mean, it's, yeah.
I mean, I can't blame them. I don't think that it's particularly that was like my thought. Cruel or anything. I think this is like, this is a guy who has been injured so grievously and it's
and we are putting ourselves at risk.
Crazy that he's still alive and there's no way he's going to survive and we can't keep him alive.
Right. And so, I agree. I wouldn't have helped.
I don't hold.
Hugh Glass has a next few years getting back at them.
If I had been Hugh Glass, maybe I would feel the same. But as an outside observer, I'm like,
I mean, I think
if I was one of these other guys, I would have probably made the same exact decision.
If you're going to leave me, make sure I'm dead. Just finish me off, please.
Yeah. A nice knife to the brain pan.
It would not have taken much more.
No. I mean, look at all the zombie movies. It's not that hard to stab somebody in the skull, apparently.
Well, I'd imagine they have guns, too, so there's that.
But that's wasting ammunition.
That's true.
So they took his fire starter and everything.
They took everything that he needed. They left him next to a spring, though. That was nice. With nothing but the bear hide that was supposed to be his burial shroud.
It was probably the bear hide of the dead bear, right?
That's what I was wondering. But Hugh Glass wasn't dead. He was conscious, even at this moment. And he was aware. He was aware. And he watched these two men steal his equipment and leave him to die alone in the wilderness.
Hmm.
If you're wondering where the Revenant got its revenge plot, this is it. But in the movie, there's a son that gets killed. And now he's on a revenge path for his son. Son never existed.
So they needed something that was a little bit more emotionally.
Maybe it's because they knew the audience would feel more like us. Well, yeah, you left him. Like, that makes sense. This guy's not going to make it. But Hugh Glass didn't feel that way. And the whole point of this revenge, like his mission, crawling back, was to get them. Hmm. He didn't just survive because he wanted to survive. He was on a mission of revenge. And I don't know, maybe they didn't feel like that was enough for us to connect with because we're like, well, duh, you, of course you'd leave him or whatever. Well, save yourself.
Interesting, yeah.
But for Hugh Glass,
I think there could have been a way that you could have done that, though.
Yeah.
If you had made him maybe a little bit more conscious and more like protesting and made the people leaving him, you know, a little bit more heartless, you could have made it that much more believable and not had to write in.
Well,
a
and it sounds like
story.
Mainly he wanted his rifle back. That gun meant a lot to him.
I don't think audiences would connect with that so much.
Right. 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 So
favorite gun.
So I
named her Bertha.
I'm not sure. Yeah. You know, it's different era. So Hugh Glass lay next to the spring, broken and alone, and had a choice to make. He could give up and die, which is what any reasonable person would do
right.
with these injuries. I'd like, hurry up. Or he could survive out of pure spite and make those two men pay for what they had done. And he chose spite. First, he had to deal with his injuries. The leg was broken, and he set it himself.
Ugh.
Right?
God.
Let that sink in for a moment. No painkillers, no medical training. He doesn't even know what he's doing beyond the basic frontier knowledge. I'm sure they probably all set bones by this point. And Hugh Glass sets his leg. The pain must have been unimaginable. I get a little nauseous just even thinking about it. But he did what he had to do. He wrapped himself in the bear hide that was supposed to be his burial shroud, and he noticed something that probably would make anyone want to vomit. Maggots were starting to infest his wounds.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah, that would.
But here's where Glass's knowledge from his time with the Pawnee kicks in. He knew maggots only eat dead flesh.
Yeah.
And not living flesh. And he knew if he let the maggots do their work, they would clean the wounds and prevent gangrene, which would kill him. So he sat and let the maggots eat and eat the dead flesh around the wounds.
That would just, oh God.
Right?
Once, like, if you have to use maggots to clean my wound, I hope I'm unconscious.
Right?
Because I don't want to deal with having to think about that happening. It probably, does it tickle?
I was kind of wondering that. I've seen it before. We didn't use the maggots purposely. We took somebody's shoe off and they all fell out with it.
But I know that in some hospitals they do use.
Yeah, like, we use leeches. I have experience using leeches, but not maggots.
Well, I know they'll like make sterile leeches, basically. Or not sterile leeches, but sterile maggots, basically. And like.
Oh, yeah, because they're created in the lab.
Yeah, and then like apply them to a wound that is gangrenous. But I think what I've read is it's usually unconscious people. Or they don't really, they don't, like, they tell them it's happening, but they don't let them see when they're doing the procedure. They drape everything off.
Well, I imagine you'd have to, it would go over time. It'd take a while.
It's a lengthy procedure. And then you have to go and like change them every day.
Yeah, that's what we would do with the leeches. You leave them on for a little while. For prescribed time, and then you take
what were
off.
The leeches being used for?
Venous. So if you have a surgery where you reconnect vessels, you can get venous congestion. So the blood backs up because the veins aren't bringing the blood back to the heart effectively yet. It takes some time. I'm holding my chin because I'm thinking about radical neck dissections, but because that's where we've used them.
Okay.
And so it just kind of pools with blood, and so they need to get that pooling out.
And that's like the safest way
so they
to
put
do
them
it.
On, and then they say like leave it on for so many minutes, and then you take them, and unfortunately you put them in alcohol and they die. You don't reuse them. But one time I came in, because the leeches will stay attached until they're full, and then they detach and wander off.
This person is unconscious, right?
No, not always.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Yeah. And I came in and I'm like, oh, it's gone. Where'd it go? And I can see a trail right up a wall.
Gross, like a slug that's gotten into the house.
Exactly.
But grosser.
Yeah, because it's got blood. I'm like, oh, that guy was not too hungry today, apparently. I digress.
He was more of an explorer.
Yes. Yeah. He had some things to go look and see. Once Glass had done what he could with his injuries, he started moving. He couldn't walk yet. His leg was broken and his body was too damaged, so he had to crawl.
Jesus.
Fort Kiowa was over 200 miles away, almost 250 miles through the wilderness, hostile territory, and terrain that would have been difficult to cross if you were healthy and well-equipped.
Yeah.
Glass had none of this equipment. His body was destroyed, and he was crawling. He ate whatever he could find, insects, snakes, berries, roots, anything that would give him calories to move along. He drank from streams when he found them, and he avoided hostile natives through a combination of luck and survival skills that he'd learned from the Pawnee.
Well, probably also he's crawling, so he's just on the forest floor. He just lays down.
Just stay and make sure there's enough brush near you that you're
Just
hidden.
Lay down under that log. It's just surprising he didn't eat like any like poisonous mushrooms or anything along the way.
And I'm wondering, he must have learned that when he was with the Pawnee.
Yeah, because he has to have probably been eating a lot of like funguses and mushrooms as he crawls along the floor, right? Forest floor. He's like, yum, yum, yum.
That'd be ideal.
Yeah. Under those logs you're crawling under, there's a lot of funguses.
Can you eat wood fungus? I don't know.
At least once. You can eat everything once.
At one point, Glass came upon a pack of wolves that had just killed a buffalo calf. Glass was desperate and starving, so he managed to scare the wolves off. I'm not sure how. And he ate the calf. He stayed there for a few days and ate from this carcass, raw buffalo, and was probably the best meal of his life.
Yeah.
Eventually, he reached the Missouri River, and this was a major milestone because now he could float the rest of the way to the Kiowa River, or to Fort Kiowa, sorry. But he had to get down the river first. Of course, he's got no way to float.
Yeah.
But according to some accounts, he encountered a group of friendly Lakota Sioux who gave him a hide boat. Other accounts say that he may have made this crude craft himself. Either way, he got on the Missouri River and floated downstream toward Fort Kiowa. On October 11th of 1823, Hugh Glass limped in to Fort Kiowa. People at the fort thought they were seeing a ghost. Glass had been reported dead. Fitzgerald and his companion had buried him, and now here he was, looking horrific, but very much alive.
They didn't quite bury him. They just left him.
Yeah. They covered him with a... Can you imagine if they did bury him?
Oh, God.
That would have been
awful.
They
covered him with a bear skin. We're like, yeah, that's good enough. We don't have a shovel.
I feel like if they would have buried him, he would have clawed his way out.
Yeah. And it would have been that out of the grave.
Because this is not even, like, he's not done surviving things. It's insane.
No.
His wounds were still festering as he was limping badly with his broken leg. He probably looked like he should have been dead, but he made it. He'd crawled, floated over 250 miles through hostile wilderness with injuries that should have killed him multiple ways, and he made it to civilization.
How did he find it?
Right? It's just, well, and I think about that all the time. Like, there's no roads, yet they seem to be able to navigate through territories very well.
Yeah.
But Glass wasn't done, not even close. He'd survived for one reason, and that was to find the men who had left him to die and make them pay. After recovering enough to travel, and we're talking basic recovery here, not fully recovering.
Yeah.
Glass set out to find John Fitzgerald and the young man who'd abandoned him. This traveling meant another 1,500 miles through dangerous territory.
Oh, geez.
He was able to find a group to travel with.
So was he just after the two people that left him for dead, or was he after, like, the entire group
nope,
that he had
just
been with?
Just the two that okay. left him for dead. And when we get back, you will find out if justice was served, if revenge was had, or if Hugh Glass has seen his last brush with death.
Dun, dun, dun.
Welcome back, and hopefully your scalp is intact and you are not breathing through the side of your neck.
Ew.
So what happened next? Along the way, Glass survived three more Arakar attacks. Three more attacks.
Wow.
9 men were killed in those attacks, but of course, Hugh Glass survived.
I got stuff to do.
I gotta get my gun. I want my gun.
Bertha. I don't know why her name is Bertha.
I don't know. I'm going to start adding that to the historical detail to see if it gets a traction, like the Jim Bridger version. Glass eventually tracks down the young man, thought to be Jim Bridger. But at the time, he was just a 19-year-old kid who'd made a terrible decision. When Glass found him, Bridger probably thought he was about to die.
Yeah.
Here was a man he'd left for dead, had somehow survived impossible odds, and tracked him down. He had to know what was coming. But Glass forgave him. Glass understood that he was a young man and that he'd probably been pressured or convinced by Fitzgerald to abandon him. So he let Bridger go. No revenge, no violence, just forgiveness.
No.
But John Fitzgerald, different story.
Yeah.
Glass tracked Fitzgerald to Fort Atkinson in June of 1824. He'd traveled 1,700 miles total, survived multiple attacks, and endured months of hardship, all to find this man and get his revenge. But when Glass finds Fitzgerald, there's a problem. Fitzgerald had joined the U.S. Army. This is a big problem because if Glass kills Fitzgerald, he'll be killing a U.S. soldier, which meant Glass would be executed.
Yeah.
All that survival, all that effort.
Yeah, would that be worth it?
All that determination, all that spite that had kept him alive, and he'd actually get... So he could get his revenge, and he didn't get it. He wasn't able to kill him.
You should have sued him.
He did.
Oh, okay, good.
Not quite.
Oh.
He didn't sue him. He had to make a choice, and at the end, he chose to live again. Fitzgerald was forced to compensate Glass. He paid him $300.
That was a lot back then.
Yeah. It was a significant sum at that time.
Yeah, that would have probably been like $15,000 or $20,000.
And he returned Glass's rifle.
Oh,
he got his gun back.
Yay, Bertha.
Glass took the money and the rifle and walked away. Now, The Revenant makes major creative liberties here. In the movie, Glass gets his revenge. There's a battle and he kills Fitzgerald.
Okay.
But in real life, that is not what happened. And you'd think after everything Glass had been through, he'd retire in a nice cabin somewhere and live out his days in peace. But no, Hugh Glass just wasn't that kind of guy. In 1824, Glass joined the Santa Fe trading expedition and later with the Etienne Provost. I'd never heard of that before, but he joined that group. And on one expedition, Glass and his party were attacked by the Shoshone natives. Glass took an arrow to the back this time. The arrowhead lodged in his back, and Glass had to endure a 700-mile journey to Taos with an arrowhead stuck
Good
in
grief.
Him. When he finally got to Taos, someone removed the arrowhead with a straight razor. And guess
Ooh.
What? He survived.
Of course he did.
His body had to look like a roadmap of every horrible thing that he'd been through.
Jeez.
He's got arrow attacks. He's got bear attack, bullet wounds, knife scars.
He must just be a mass of scar tissue. Yeah.
Gosh, that seems painful too. Scar tissue can be very painful, especially after the bear attack, because you wouldn't heal. Like it wouldn't be approximated, we call it, where it's like,
well, yeah, and his leg was probably didn't heal not great. Set, right? He just set it himself.
Yeah, he limped for the rest of his life.
He had a hole in
his
trachea.
Right, that's the piece. I'm like, how did he survive
all of the
that?
Neck trauma would have, he was probably in pain every
and missed
single
the
day
carotid?
Of his life. Yeah.
Crazy.
We think our backs hurt. Jeez.
I know. I feel like I should not complain as much after
people have
researching
lovers,
this story. Yeah. So from 1831 to 1833, Glass worked as a Freeman trader at Fort Union. He was in his 50s at this point, and in the 1830s frontier era, that's ancient.
Yeah.
He's real old. Most men didn't live that long, so he was definitely made it longer than most. But Glass wasn't most men. He relocated to Fort Cass, where he worked as a hunter. He was still out there, still surviving, and still refusing to settle down and die like a normal person. And then, in the spring of 1833, Hugh Glass's luck finally ran out. Mm. Glass was traveling with two companions, Edward Rose and Hillian Menard. They were crossing a frozen river when they were ambushed by the Arikara war party.
Oh. There they come again.
Yep. The tribe had attacked Ashley's expedition back in 1823, and also while Glass was traveling to find Fitzgerald. So he'd been attacked by them multiple times. They had been a thorn in the side of trappers and traders for years, and now they had Hugh Glass in their rights. I'd like to say that the trappers were a thorn in their side.
I was going to say, yeah. It depends on who you're talking to.
Glass, Rose, and Menard were shot, scalped, and killed, all three of them. After everything Glass had survived, pirates, the Pawnee, the grizzly bear, the 200-mile crawl, the multiple Arikara attacks, and an arrow in the back, he was finally killed by the same tribe that had wounded him a decade earlier. So that is how Hugh Glass's life finally ended.
Wow.
Like I said, I can't believe he's not still here today. Keep surviving everything. But let's talk about The Revenant for a minute, because that's how most people know Hugh Glass's story. But it's important to understand that the film has a lot of creative liberties. The sun, we've talked about the sun. That was not there. No sun ever existed. There was no retribution needed there. Second, the timeline. The movie compresses everything into what feels like about a week.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, the crawl to Fort Kiowa from where he was injured was 6 weeks. That's after he got himself patched up enough to even begin crawling. For another 6 weeks, he worked his way over.
Well, remember that period of his life from when he got attacked by the bear until he finally caught up with Fitzgerald was probably 1 to 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. Like all the other eras. Third, the revenge in the movie. Like we talked about, Glass gets a dramatic, violent confrontation with his betrayers. But in reality, he forgives the first one and then has to just settle on the terms of the second.
It's not as exciting, though. Like being like, okay, fine.
It's not satisfying. I want revenge.
Here's a couple $100 and in your gun back.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Right. So like, anticlimactic for everything he went through. It's so anticlimactic.
That would not make a good movie.
No.
Yeah.
And then fourth, there's various details about the bear attack and the aftermath. The movie shows Glass being attacked near a river and immediately being found by his companions. In reality, he was hunting ahead of them and they had to run and catch up and help save him. The movie also shows Glass being left almost immediately, when in reality it had been over a week surviving. So they didn't just make that decision on day one. The other difference is that the two men stayed with him for 5 days after abandoning him. But like I mentioned earlier, the movie apparently does not represent the injuries as
like the extent
of them and how horrific they were. I mean, it's just absolutely unsurvivable.
Yeah.
Absolutely unsurvivable. And he managed to do it. So the real Hugh Glass crawled 200 miles with worse injuries than the movie shows, survived for 6 weeks on insects and roots and snakes, and walked another 1,500 miles through hostile territory. The movie made it look hard, but in reality, it was much, much harder. Crazy story, huh?
Yeah, that's nuts.
I was just looking for weird survival stories and came across Hugh Glass. And then I started reading into it. And I'm like, oh, I know this story. I've seen The Revenant. And then I started really researching. I'm like, holy cow, this man is amazing. Survival survivability.
Yeah. Yeah. The determination.
Right. I wonder too, thinking sometimes like, was he thinking, why can't I just die?
Maybe.
Why do I keep waking up alive?
God.
I guess I'm alive. I better get it together here.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
What a story. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Special thanks to Letha at EasyBrzy, EasyBrzy.com for her, our beautiful new website. And Logan Hine, he's our social media manager at Logan@redemptionindustries.com. Thank you very much to them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. And thank you to the MSW Media Network. We're a proud member now of MSW Media Network, amplifying truth, justice, and accountability. So thank you very much to Allison Gill and the MSW Media Network. Thank you to our listeners and our supporters. Hey, if you liked this story, we got more over at our Patreon. So for just as little as $5 a month, you can get all access to all of our bonus content, along with ad-free episodes early, sometimes up to 4 days early. And if you're at the higher tiers, you also get little special merch. Go on over to rainydayrabbitholes.com to explore more of our episodes and to sign up for our Patreon. And if supporting our Patreon isn't in it for you right now, just tell a friend. We would appreciate that. Reach out on social media, YouTube, at Rainy Day Rabbit Holes everywhere. And we will see you next time. And
see you down the rabbit hole. It does not cover it fully.
No, your natural deodorant does not work. I'm so sorry, everybody who thinks that natural deodorant works. It does not.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating. And just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.